to end. Look, a path, Ashley says. What is this? It's wider up ahead. Out here in nowhere, we're on a Roman road in incredibly good condition for long stretches. We never have reached the end, but Beppe, who knows it from childhood, told us it goes to the top of Monte San Egidio, 20 kilometers away. Instead of winding and skirting, Roman roads tend to go straight to the top. The chariots were light, and the shortest distance between two points seemed to have governed their surveyors. I've read that some of their roadbeds go down 12 feet. Cortona lies below us, and below the town, the valley, and the horizon look polished and gleaming. We see mountains in the distance we've never seen, and the hill towns of Sinulunga, Montepulciano, and Monte San Savino rise sharply like three ships sailing against the sky. The last knot of my unrest unravels. I start to hum. I saw three ships come sailing in on Christmas Day in the morning. A red fox leaps down onto the path ahead of us. He sweeps his plumy tail back and forth, regards us for a moment, then darts into the woods. The road to Fenella and Peter's noble farmhouse is rough enough in summer. Now we're holding on to pots and trays and trying not to empty them into one another's laps. The poor Twingo's axle. We ford several impromptu streams and almost get stuck in a washout of near-ditch proportions. When we arrive, everyone is gathered by the gigantic fireplace, already into the red wine. This is one of the most magnificent houses in the local vernacular. The living room, formerly a granary, soars two stories high with rows of dark beams. The immense room is filled with a lifetime collection of antiques, rugs, and treasures. The space is too large to heat, however, so we settle into big sofas in the former kitchen, with its fireplace large enough for the original cooks to set their chairs inside and tend their pots. Downstairs, the 30-foot-long table is laid with pine boughs and red candles. Ghosts of Christmases past join us in everyone's stories of other holidays. Fenella pours the hot polenta onto a cutting board. Ed carves the faraone, while Peter slices the succulent roast. We pile our plates. Fenella has journeyed to Montepulciano for a stash of her favorite vino nobile, which travels around the table. To absent friends, Fenella toast. To the polenta, Ed rejoins. Our little expatriate band is merry, merry. En route home, we stop in town for a coffee. We expect the streets to be deserted on Christmas night at 9 o'clock. But everyone is out, every baby and grandmother, and everyone in between, walking and talking, always talking. Well, Jess, your objective, I say. You're new here, so you must tell me if I'm under an illusion. Or is this the most divine town on the planet? Without a pause, he says, I'd say so, yes, extra primo good. The Passeggiata activity is to stroll from church to church, viewing the scenes of Christ's birth. The reminder of birth is everywhere, is still the major focus of Christmas here. Pagan, I suppose I am, but I think what a glorious metaphor the birth is at year's end, the dark and dead end of the year. The one cry of the baby in the damp straw, and death is denied. The baby in every scene has a nimbus of light around his head. The sun is crossing the celestial equator, bringing back the days I love. 1 foot over, and we're on a swing toward light. That restless urge at this season, maybe it's the desire to find the light of one's own again. I've read that the body contains minerals in the exact proportions that the earth does. The percentages of zinc and potassium in the earth are the same amounts we have in our bodies. Could the body have an innate desire to imitate the earth's push toward rebirth? All the Cortona churches display their Presepe, nativity scenes. Some are elaborate reproductions of paintings in wax and wood models with elaborate architecture and costume. Some are terracotta. One crib is made of ice cream sticks. At the middle school's exhibit of students' presepe, we're touched to see the children's less ornate versions. Most are traditional, with small dolls, twig trees, and hand mirror ponds, but one astonishes us. Paolo Alunni, aged perhaps 10, is a true heir of the futurists and their love for the mechanical and its energy. His creche, Stable People and Animals, is constructed entirely of keys. The animal keys are horizontal, and it's clear which are sheep, which are cows. The humans are upright, except for the cunning little diary-sized key that is the baby Jesus. He's made the stable roof from a hinge. Eerie and effective, a stunning piece of art among all the Ernest projects. Every morning I look out the window at the valley, filled with fog, pink-tinted at dawn on clear days, a roiling gray when high clouds blow across from the north. These are seamless days of walks and books, of taking trips to Anghiari, Siena, Assisi, and nearby Lucignano, whose town walls describe a graceful ellipse. At night we grill in the fireplace, bruschetta with melted pecorino and walnuts, slices of fresh pecorino with prosciutto and sausages. Scamorza, more native to the Abruzzo, but growing popular in Tuscany, is a hard rind cheese shaped like an eight. It melts to almost a fondue, and we spread it on bread. I learned to use the hearth to warm plates and keep food hot, just as my imagined nonna must have done. Our favorite pasta becomes peachy con funghi e salsicce, pencil-thick pasta with wild mushrooms and the grilled sausages. A 7-mile walk along the fire road cancels out the effect of one evening of grilling. On New Year's Eve, I am coming home from town with a carload of groceries. We're cooking the traditional lentils, tiny coin shapes of the symbol of prosperity, and zampone, sausage in the shape of a pig's foot. As I climb the road toward home, I pass the dome of Santa Maria Nuova below me. Fog completely surrounds the church, and the dome floats above the clouds. 5 intersecting rainbows dive and arch around the dome. I almost run off the road. At the curve, I stop and get out, wishing everyone were with me. This is staggering. If it were the Middle Ages, I'd claim a miracle. Another car stops, and a man dressed in fancy hunting clothes jumps out. He, too, looks stunned. We both just stare. As the clouds shift, the rainbows disappear one by one, but the dome still drifts, ready for any sign that might be about to happen. I wave to the hunter. Auguri, he calls. Before Ashley and Jess go back to New York, where serious winter waits to kick in, and before we go back to San Francisco, where paperwhite narcissi already are blooming in Golden Gate Park, we plant the Christmas tree. I expect the ground to be hard, but it is not. Loamy and rich, it yields to the shovel. As Jess shovels dirt, the white skull of a hedgehog turns up with its perfectly articulated jaw and teeth still attached by a string of ligament. Memento mori, a useful thought as the end of 1 year folds into the new. The sturdy tree looks immediately at home on the lower terrace. As it grows, it will tower over the road below. From the upstairs, we'll see its peak growing higher and higher each year. If the rains these first few years are plentiful, in 50 years it may be the giant tree of the hillside. Ashley, old by then, may remember planting it. Because she is flush with beauty, I can't imagine her old. She will come with her friends or family, all of whom will marvel. Or strangers who own the house may take its lower limbs for firewood. Surely Bramasole will still be here, with olives we've planted thriving on the terraces. Rose Walk. In the 10 hours upright in my aisle seat, headed from San Francisco to Paris, I read with intense concentration a history of experimental French poetry, the flight magazine, even the emergency instruction card. So many crises happened at work before I left California for Bramasole at the end of May that I wanted to be loaded onto the plane on a stretcher, wrapped in white, put in the front aisle with curtains around me, the flight attendant looking in now and then with a cup of warm milk or a sapphire gin martini. I left a week before Ed finished his classes, fled, really, on the first plane smoking on the runway the day after graduation. After a short wait at Charles de Gaulle, I caught an Alitalia flight. The pilot wasted no time in heading straight up. An Italian driver, I guess, is an Italian driver. Suddenly I felt a surge of energy. I wondered if he was trying to pass someone. Soon he aimed down, almost straight down, toward the Pisa airport. No one seemed alarmed, so I practiced breathing evenly and holding up the plane by the armrest. I'm staying overnight. If we had been late, the prospect of changing trains in Florence at night sounded exhausting. I check into a hotel and find I'm ready to walk. It's passeggiata hour. Hordes of people mingling, visiting, strolling, running errands. The tower still leans. Tourists still take photos of themselves, leaning to one side or the other in front of it. The pastel and ochre houses still curve along the river. Women with shopping bags crowd into the fragrant bread store. Splendid to arrive alone in a foreign country and feel the assault of difference. Here they are all along, busy with living. They don't talk or look like me. The rhythm of their day is entirely different. I am thoroughly foreign. I have dinner at an outdoor restaurant on a piazza. Ravioli, roast chicken, green beans, salad, a half carafe of local red. Then my elation ebbs, and a total delicious tiredness rushes over me. After a soaking bath with all the hotel's bubble bath, I sleep for 10 hours. The first morning train takes me through fields of red poppies in bloom, olive groves, and by now familiar stony villages. Haystacks, nuns in white, four abreast, bed linens flung out the window, sheepfold, oleander, Italy. I stare out the window the whole way. It's fun to get off at the Florence station, which always brings me the fresh memory of my first trip to Italy almost 25 years ago, the exotic smoky sound of the loudspeaker announcing the arrival from Rome on Binario 11 and the departure for Milano on Binario 1, the oily train smells and everyone going somewhere. Fortunately, the train is almost empty, and I easily stow my bags. Midway home, home, I've said to myself, a cart comes through with sandwiches and drinks. The train doesn't stop at Camuccia, so I get off at Tarantola, about 10 miles away, and call a taxi. 15 minutes later, a taxi pulls up. As soon as I get in, a second taxi pulls alongside us, and the driver starts to shout and gesture. I assume the taxi I got in was the one I called, but no, he just happened along. He does not want to give up the fare. I tell him I called a taxi, but he starts to take off. The other driver bangs on the door, shouting louder. He was having lunch. He drove here especially for the Americana. He has to earn his bread, too. Spit gathers in the corners of his lips, and I'm afraid he's about to foam at the mouth. Stop, please. I should go with him. I'm very sorry. My driver growls, slams on brakes, jerks my bag out. I get in the other taxi. They face off to each other, both talking at once, jowls and fists shaking. Then abruptly come to terms and start shaking hands, smiling. The deserted driver comes around to me, smiles, and wishes me a good trip. When I arrive, my sister, nephew, and friends of theirs have been at the house for a couple of weeks. My sister has had all the pots planted with white and coral geraniums. The green smell of freshly cut grass tells me Beppe must have mown the lawn this morning. Despite my severe pruning in December, the roses we planted last summer are as tall as I am, They're profuse with bloom, apricot, white, pink, yellow. Hundreds of butterflies flitter among the lavender. The house has vases of gold lilies and daisies and wildflowers. It's clean and full of life. My sister even has a pot of basil going outside the kitchen door. They are on a day trip to Florence when I arrive, so I have the afternoon to pull the duffel out from under the bed and air my summer clothes. Late, I find my boots and walk the terraces. Beppe and Francesco have cut the weeds. I've lost the battle of the wildflowers. In their zeal to clear, they have stopped for nothing, not even the wild roses I know as Cherokee roses. Poppies, wild carnations, some fluffy white flower, and the host of yellow-blooming weeds survive only along the terrace edges. The big news is the olives. In March, they planted 30 in the gaps on the terraces, bringing us up to 150 trees. Already they're flowering. Beppe and Francesco staked each new tree and stuffed a nest of weeds between the stake and the trunk to prevent chafing. Ed knew to dig a big hole for each tree, but he didn't know to dig an enormous, deep one. Beppe explained that the new trees need a big pulmone, a lung. Around each, they've dug to a circumference of around 4 feet. They also planted 2 more cherries to go with the ones Ed planted last spring. For a week, we cook, run around to Arezzo and Perugia, walk, buy scarves and sheets at the Camuccia market, and catch up on family news. Ed arrives in time for a farewell dinner, with liberal pourings of several Brunellos my nephew bought in Montalcino. Then they pack, 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 so much to buy here, and are gone. They've had a warm May. Now it begins to rain. The run-rampant roses bend and sway in the wind. We run out with shovels and stake them, getting soaked. Ed digs while I clip off the dead blooms, cut back some of the stalky branches, and give them fertilizer, though I'm afraid it will promote even more of the jack-in-the-beanstalk mode. I cut an armful of white ones that bloom in ready-made bouquets. Inside, we iron our clothes, rearrange what has been shifted as many people made themselves comfortable to their own tastes. Everything quickly falls into place. Eons ago, it seems, I arrived in June to find ladders, workmen, pipes, wires, rubble, and dust everywhere. Now we just begin living. A pot of minestrone for the rainy nights, a walk over the Roman road into town for cheese, arugula, coffee. Maria Rita's cherries are the best ever. We eat a kilo every 24 hours. All the stump and stone removal and clearing has paid off. Cleaning up the land is easier now. Not as many rocks fly up when the weed machine splits through the weeds. How many stones have we picked up? Enough to build a house? Fireflies flickering on the terraces at night. Cuckoos in the soft blue dawns. A timid bird that sings, sweet, sweet. Hoopoes all dressed up in their exotic plumage, with nothing more to do than peck in the dirt. Long days with bird songs instead of the sound of the telephone. We plant more roses. In this area of Tuscany, they bloom spectacularly. Almost every garden spills and flourishes with them. We select a Paul Neyron with ruffled hot pink petals like a tutu and an astonishing lemony rose scent. I must have 2 of the soft pink ones the size of tennis balls, called Donna Morella Agnelli. Their perfume carries me back to the memory of being hugged to the bosom of Delia, one of my grandmother's friends, who wore immense hats and was a kleptomaniac no one ever accused because it would embarrass her husband to death. When he noticed a new object around the house, he would stop into the store he figured it came from and say, "My wife completely forgot to pay for this. Just walked right out with it in her hand and remembered last night. How much do I owe you?" Perhaps her powdery rose perfume was stolen. Don't plant any peace roses, a friend and connoisseur of roses advised. They're such a cliché. But not only are they dazzling, The vanilla cream, peach, and rosy blush colors repeat the colors of the house. They belong in this garden. I plant several. Last year's gold-orange roses open to flagrant size, the rash colors contributing to their beautiful vulgarity. Now we have a line of roses all along the walk up to the house, with lavender planted between each one. I'm coming to believe in aromatherapy. As I walk to the house through waves of scent, it's impossible not to inhale deeply and feel an infusion of happiness. At the steps up to the front terrace, an old iron pergola remains at the top and the bottom, with jasmine we planted 2 years ago, twining around them and down the iron railings of the steps. Now we decide on another long row of roses on the other side of the walk, and a pergola at the opposite end of that walk. Two roses we choose, one milky pink, one a velvet red, are Queen Elizabeth and Abe Lincoln, pronounced Ebe Lincone at the nursery. Nice to think of those two forces side by side. My favorites start as one color and open to another. Joya, joy, is pearly as a bud and full-blown turns straw yellow, with some petals still veined and edged with pink. We plant more of the apricot dawn roses, one that's traffic light yellow, a pompadour, and one named for Pope John the 23rd. So many important people just blooming in our garden. I don't resist a decadent, smoked lilac one that looks as if it belongs in the hand of someone in a coffin. I've had several gardens but never have planted roses. When I was a child, my father landscaped around the cotton mill he managed for my grandfather. With a single-mindedness I can only wonder at, he planted 1,000 roses, all the same kind. L'Étoile d'Olon, a vital, heart's blood red rose, is the flower of my father. To put it mildly, he was a difficult man, and to complicate that, he died at 47. Until he died, our house always was filled with his roses, large vases, crystal bowls, single silver bud vases on every available surface. They never wilted because he had someone cut a fresh armful every day during seasons of bloom. I can see him at noon coming in the back door in his beige linen suit, somehow not rumpled from the heat. He carries, like a baby in his arms, a cone of newspaper around a mass of red, red buds. "Would you look at these?" He hands them to Willie Bell, who already is waiting with scissors and vases. He twirls his Panama hat on the tip of his finger. "Just tell me, who needs to go to heaven?" In my gardens, I've planted herbs, Iceland poppies, fuchsias, pansies, sweet William. Now I am in love with roses. We have enough grass now that I can walk out in the dew barefooted every morning and cut a rose and a bunch of lavender for my desk. Memory cuts and comes again. At the mill, my father kept a single rose on his desk. I realize I have planted only one red one. As the morning sun hits, the double fragrance intensifies. Now that so much work is finished, we taste the future. A time is coming when we will just garden, maintain, refine. We have a list of pleasurable projects, such as stone walkways, a fresco on the kitchen wall, antique hunting trips to the Marche region, an outdoor bread oven, and a list of less glorious projects, figuring out the septic system, which sends out a frightening turnip smell when lots of people are using the house, cleaning and repointing the stone walls of the cantina, rebuilding sections of stone walls that have collapsed on several terraces, retiling the butterfly bathroom. These would have seemed major once, and now just seem like things on a list. Still, days are near when we will work with an Italian tutor, take the wildflower book on long walks, travel to the Veneto, Sardinia, and Apulia, even take a boat from Brindisi or Venice to Greece. To embark from Venice, where the first touch of the East is felt. That time is not yet, however. The last big project looms. The yard-thick living room wall will be open to connect with the contadina kitchen, which will get a new floor new plaster, new wiring. Primo Bianchi chugs up the driveway in his Ape, loaded with bags of cement. He jumps out to direct a large white truck full of sand, steel I-beams, and bricks as it backs up the narrow driveway, scraping its mirror on the pine trees and pulling off one limb of a spruce with a loud crack. Primo was our first choice for remodeling 3 years ago, but was unable to work then because of a stomach operation. He looks the same, like an escapee from Santa's workshop. We go over the project. He nods. 5 giorni, signori. 5 days. After 2 weeks, I'm wondering, will this go on forever? During the Renaissance, it was a custom to open Virgil at random and place a finger on a line that would foretell the future or answer a burning question. In the South, we used to do this with the Bible. People always have had ways to grasp for revelation. The Etruscans' heruspication, reading omens from sacrificed animals' livers, is no stranger than the Greeks finding significance in the flight patterns of birds and the droppings of animals. I opened Virgil and put my finger down on the years take all, one's wits included. Not very encouraging. Twenty-one days later, not only this project, but the whole major restoration that has stretched over 3 years is ending today. We're entertaining friends in the sun-dappled bower, just as I envisioned. I go into the kitchen and begin arranging a selection of local cheeses on grape leaves. I'm flushed and excited in my white linen dress with short sleeves that stand out like little wings. Above me, Primo is scraping the floor. I look up. He has removed 2 tiles and there is a hole in the ceiling. Just as I look back at my cheese platter, Primo accidentally kicks over his bucket and cement pours onto my head. My hair, my dress, the cheese, my arms, the floor. I look up and see his startled face peering down like a cherub in a fresco. The humor is not entirely lost on me. I walk out to the table, dribbling cement. After dropped jaws and stunned looks, everyone laughs. Primo runs out, hitting the heel of his hand to his forehead. The guests clear up while I shower. With Primo, they're all sitting along the sun-warmed wall when I come down. Now Primo will join us in a toast. The guests are toasting an amusing day and the end of the project. Ed and I, having been literally doused in this restoration, raise our glasses, too. Primo just enjoys himself. He launches into a history of his teeth and shows us big gaps in his mouth. 5 years ago, he had such a toothache. He holds his head and leans over moaning that he pulled out his own tooth with the pliers. Via, via, he shouts, motioning the tooth out of his jaw. Via somehow sounds more emphatic than go. Relics of Summer. The fonts in all the churches are dry. I run my fingers through the dusty scallops of marble, not a drop for my hot forehead. The Tuscan July heat is invasive to the body, but not to the stone churches that hold on to the dampness of winter, releasing a gray coolness slowly throughout the summer. In the vast church of San Biagio, below Montepulciano, there's an airy quiet as you enter. Right under the dome, you can stand in one spot and speak or clap your hands, and far up against the inner cup of the dome, an eerie echo sends the sound rapidly back. The quality of the sound is not like the hello across a lake, but a sharp, repeated return. Your voice flattened, otherworldly. It is hard to think a mocking angel isn't hovering against the frescoes, though more likely a pigeon rests there. Since I have been spending summers in Cortona, the major shock and joy is how at home I feel, but not just at home, returned to that primal first awareness of home. I feel at home because dusty trucks park at intersections and sell watermelons, the same thump to test for ripeness. The boy holds up a rusty iron scale with discs of different sizes for counterweight. His arm muscle jumps up like Popeye's and the breeze brings me a whiff of his scent of dry grasses, onions, and dirt. In big storms, lightning drives a jagged stake into the ground, and hailstones bounce in the yard, bringing back the smell of ozone to me from Georgia days, when I'd gather a bowl full, size of ping-pong balls, and put them in the freezer. Sweltering nights, the air comes close to body temp, and shifting constellations of fireflies compete with stars. Mosquito nights, grabbing at air, the mosquito caught in my hair. Long days when I can taste the sun. I move through this foreign house I've acquired as though my real ancestors left their presences in these rooms, as though this were the place I always came home to. Living near a small town again certainly is part of it, and living again with nature. Clouds swarm in from over the lake, and thunder cracks along my backbone, booms like waves boom far out at sea. I write in my notebook, the dishwasher was struck. We heard the sizzle. But isn't it good, the gigantic storm, the flood of terror they felt beside fires in the cave? The thunder shakes me like a kitten the big cat has picked up by the neck. I ricochet home, heat lightning. I'm lying on the ground 4,000 miles from here, letting rain soak through me. Rain flays the grapes. Nature, what's ripe? Will the driveway wash away? When to dig potatoes? How much water is in the irrigation well? Early life reconnects. I go out to get wood. A black scorpion scuttles over my hand, and suddenly I remember the furry tarantulas in the shower at Lakemont, the shriek when my barefooted mother stepped on one and felt it crunch, then squash up soft as a banana between her toes. Is it the spill of free days? I dream my mother rinses my tangle of hair with a bowl of rainwater. Sweet time, exaggerated days, getting up at dawn, because when the midsummer sun tops the crest across the valley, the first rays hit me in the face, like they strike some rock at Stonehenge on the solstice. To be fully awake when the sky turns rose-streaked coral and scarves of fog drift across the valley and the wild canaries sing. In Georgia, my father and I used to get up to walk the beach at sunrise. At home in San Francisco, what wakes me is the alarm at 7, or the carpool horn blowing for the child downstairs, or the recycle truck with its crashing cascade of glass. I love the city and never have felt really at home there. I was drawn to the surface of Italy for its perched towns, the food, language, and art. I was pulled also to its sense of lived life, the coexistence of times that somehow gives an aura of timelessness. I toast the Etruscan wall above us with my coffee every morning. All the big abstracts that act out in everything, from the aggression on the autostrada to the afternoon stroll through the piazza. I cast my lot here for a few short months a year, because my curiosity for the layered culture of the country is inexhaustible. But the umbilical that is totally unexpected and elides logic reaches to me through the church. To my surprise, I have bought a ceramic Mary with a small cup for home use of holy water. As a fallen-away Methodist, then a fallen-away Episcopalian, I suppose my holy water is a sham. However, I have taken it from the spring I discovered near the house, the artesian spring where clear water rises in a declivity of white stone. It must have been the house's original source, or it's older than the house, medieval, Roman, Etruscan. Though some interior juggling is going on, I do not expect to emerge as a Catholic, or even as a believer. I'm essentially pagan by birth. Southern populism was boiled into my blood early. The idea of a pope with the last word gives me hives. Idolatrous, our minister called the worship of Mary and the saints. Briefly in college, I was drawn to the romance of the Mass, especially the 3 a.m. Fisherman's Mass in St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans. I lost interest in the whole show when my good friend, a New Orleans Catholic, told me in complete seriousness that mortal sin began if you kissed longer than 10 seconds. A 10-second French kiss was okay, but a dry 20-second kiss would land you in trouble. Though I still like rituals, even empty ones, what magnetizes me here feels more radical. Now I love the quick mass in tiny Upper Cortona churches, where the same sounds have provided a still point for the residents for almost 800 years. When a black Labrador wandered in, the priest interrupted his holy spiel to shout, "For the love of God, somebody get that dog out of here." If I stop in on a weekday morning, I sit there alone, enjoying the country Baroque. I think, here I am. I love the parade of relics through the streets, with gold-robed priests traveling along in a billow of incense, their way prepared by children in white, scattering the streets with petals of broom, rose, daisy. In the noon heat, I almost hallucinate. What's in the gold box held aloft with banners? A splinter from the cradle? Never mind we thought Jesus was born in a lowly manger. This is the splinter of the true cradle. Or am I confused? It's a splinter of the true cross. It is on its way through the streets, brought out into the air one day a year. And suddenly I think, what did that hymn mean, cleft for me, rising years ago, perpendicular from the white board church in Georgia? In my south there were signs on trees that said repent. Halfway up a skinny pine, up beyond the tin trough that caught the resin, hung a warning, Jesus is coming. Here, when I turn on the car radio, a lulling voice implores Mary to intercede for us in purgatory. In the nearby town, one church has as its relic a phial of holy milk. On the terrace at noon, I'm tanning my legs as I read about early martyrs and medieval saints. I'm drawn to the martyred San Lorenzo, who was put on a grill for his troublesome faith and seared until he reportedly said, "Turn me over, I'm done on this side," and thereby became the favorite saint of chefs. The virginal young women martyrs all were raped, stabbed, tortured, or locked away because of their devotion to Christ. Stunning the prevalence of the miracle. In the Middle Ages, some of the venerated women found the foreskin of Jesus materialized in their mouths. I don't know if there exists a relic of that. Would it look like a chewed rubber band, a dried wad of bubble gum? The foreskin stops me for a good 10 minutes, and I stare out at the bees swarming the tea trees, trying to imagine the event happening, and not just once. The moment of recognition, what she said, what the reaction was, a boggling speculation. Somehow I've never heard of these kinkier saints in America. Now I read on and find that some had holy anorexia and lived on the wafer alone. If a saint's bones were dug up, a flowery fragrance filled the town. After St. Francis preached to the birds, they flew up into the shape of a cross, then separated into the four directions. The saints would eat the pus and lice of the poor to show their humility. In turn, the faithful liked to drink the bathwater of a holy person. If after death a saint's heart was cut out, perhaps an image of the Holy Family carved in a ruby would be found inside. Oh, I realize. Here's where they put their all. I understand that. I understand because this everyday wildness and wonder come back so naturally from the miracle-hungry South. They almost seem like memories somehow. The vertebra of the Virgin, the toenail of San Marco. My favorite, the breath of San Giuseppe, foster father of Christ. I imagine an opaque green glass bottle with a ground stopper, the swift exhaling of air as it opened. At home when I was small, our seamstress kept her jar of gallstones on the windowsill above her singer. Marking my hem, her mouth full of pins, she'd say, "Lord, I don't want to go through nothing like that again. Now you turn round. Those things won't even dissolve in gasoline." Her talisman against sickness, emblems and omens. Santa Dorothea immured in her cell for 2 years against a high-walled pit in the dank cathedral, communion through a grate and a diet of bread and gruel. I hated visiting Miss Tibby, who treated the corns on my mother's little toes, shaving yellow curls of skin off with a vegetable peeler, then rubbing her feet with thick lotion that smelled like crankcase oil and Ovaltine. The bare bulb lit not only my mother's foot on the cushion, but also a coffin where Miss Tibby slept at night so there would be no surprises later. In high school, my friends and I parked a block away and secretly peered in the windows of the Holy Rollers, who spoke in tongues, sometimes screaming, with a frighteningly ecstatic look on their faces and falling to the floor, writhing and jerking. We were profane, smothering our laughter at the surely sexual fervor and the contorted postures. Later we'd sit in the car and watch them file out of the peeling church, looking as normal as anyone. In Naples, the file of San Gennaro's congealed blood liquefies once a year. There's also a crucifix that used to grow one long hair of Jesus that would have to be barbered once a year. That one seems particularly close to Southern sensibilities. Growing up in the God-fearing, faith-healing end-of-the-world-is-at-hand South gave me many chances to visit snake collections beside gas stations when my parents stopped to fill up, to drive past roadside religious ceremonies in which snakes were ecstatically handled, to see shabby Wonders of the World exhibits, reliquaries of sorts, in the towns bordering the swamps. I know a box of black cat's bones makes a powerful conjure, and that a bracelet of dimes can ward it off. I was used to cages of baby alligators crawling on the back of the mother of all, a 14-foot beauty who opened her jaws wide enough that I could have stood in them, albino deer covered with ticks that leapt on my hand when I petted their mossy noses, a stuffed painter, panther, with green marbles for eyes, a 30-foot tapeworm in a jar. The owner explains that it was taken from the throat of his 17-year-old niece when the doctor lured it out of her stomach with a clove of garlic on a toothpick. They waited until it showed its head, lured it out further, then grabbed, chopped off its head with a straight razor while hauling the thing out of Darlene's stomach like a rope out of the river. Wonders, miracles. In cities, we're less and less capable of the imagination for the super-real, ground down as we are by reality. In rural areas, close to the stars and groves, we're still willing to give it a whirl. Soleone. Soleone. How useful the O-N-E suffix in Italian. The noun expands. Porta, door, becomes portone, and there's no doubt which is the main door. Torre becomes Torrione, the name of our part of Cortona, where a great tower must have stood once. Minestrone, then, always is a big soup. Days of high summer. Soleone, big sun. Dog days, we call them in the South. Our cook told me the name was because it was so hot that dogs went mad and bit people, and I would be bitten if I didn't mind her. Eventually, I was disappointed to find the name only meant that Sirius, the dog star, was rising and setting with the sun. Here the expanded sun fills the sky, as in the archetypal child's drawing of house, tree, and sun. The cicadas are in the know. They provide the perfect accompaniment to this heating up. By dawn, they're hitting their horizon note of high screech. How a finger-sized insect can make such a racket only by vibrating its thorax, I don't know. As they tune up to their highest pitch, it sounds as though someone is shaking tambourines made from the small bones of the ear. By noon, they've switched to sitars, that most irritating of instruments. Only the wind quiets them. Perhaps they must hang on to a limb and can't clutch and vibrate at the same time. But the wind seldom blows except for the evil appearance now and then of the scirocco, which gusts but doesn't cool, while the sun roars. If I were a cat, I would arch my back. This hot wind brings particles of dust from the African deserts and deposits them in your throat. I hang out the clothes and they're dry in minutes. The papers in my study fly around like released white doves, then settle in the four corners of the room. The tea are dropping a few dry leaves, and the flowers suddenly seem leached of color, although we have had enough rain this summer that we have been able to water faithfully every day. The hose pulls water directly from the old well, and they must feel blasted at the end of the hot day by the rush of icy water. Perhaps this has exhausted them. The pear tree on the front terrace has the look of a woman 2 weeks overdue. We should have thinned the fruit. Branches are breaking under the weight of golden pears just turning ruddy. I can't decide whether to read metaphysics or to cook. The ultimate nature of being or cold garlic soup. They are not so far apart after all. Or if they are, it doesn't matter. It's too hot to think about it. The hotter the day, the earlier I walk. 8, 7, 6 o'clock, and even then I rub my face with number 30 sunblock. The coolest walks start at Torrione. A downhill road leads to Le Celle, a 12th century monastery where St. Francis's minute cell still opens onto a seasonal, torrential stream. Many of the first Franciscan monks who lived as hermits on Monte San Egidio started Le Celle in 1211. The architecture, a stacked stone honeycomb up against the hillside, recalls their caves. When I walk there, peace and solitude are palpable. In early summer, the rush of water down the steep canyon makes its own music, and sometimes above that, I hear singing. By now, the stream is almost dry. Their vegetable garden looks like a model. One of the Capuchin friars, who lives there now, trudges uphill barefooted toward town. He's wearing his scratchy brown robe and strange pointed white hat, hence Cappuccino, using two sticks to pull himself along. With his white beard and fierce brown eyes, he looks like an apparition from the Middle Ages. When I pass him, he smiles and says, "Buongiorno, signora, bene qua," nice here, indicating the landscape with a rotation of his beard. He glides by, Father Time on cross-country skis. But I take the slightly uphill road this morning. The road is just a white track through pine and chestnut forest. No cars, no people. The shoulders look as though someone scattered one of those cans of native wildflower seeds, and they all took root, then flourished. I climb a hill to look at an abandoned house, so old that it still has a thick slate roof. Brambles surround the doors and windows. I glimpse dark rooms with stone walls. In front, I look down on a 180-degree view of Cortona in profile, and on the entire length of the Val di Chiana, a yellow and green patchwork of sunflower and vegetable fields. The upstairs must have a low ceiling, right for a crude bed made of chestnut limbs, a white goose-down quilt. The terrace should go there, in front of the lilac bushes. A pink rose still blooms its heart out without any care at all. Whose was it? The wife of a silent woodcutter who smoked his pipe and drank grappa in the winter evenings when the Tramontana shook the windows on the back side of the house? Perhaps she growled at him for sticking her so far in the country. No, she was content with her work, embroidering the linens for the Contessa. The house is small, but who would stay inside when there's a broad terrace overlooking the world? The waiting house, all potential. To see one and start dreaming is to imagine being extant in another version. Someone eventually will buy it and perhaps will run all over Tuscany looking for old slate to restore the roof authentically. Or the new owner might rip off the roof and put on flat new tiles. Whatever the predilections, the owner will respond to the Aries isolation, that and the magnetic pull of the panorama, a place to linger and soothe the restless beast every day. At the end of the road, a path through the woods leads to our favorite Roman road. I suppose it was laid by slaves. When I first heard about the Roman road near our house, I assumed it was unique. Not long after that, I saw a rather thick book on the many Roman roads of this area. Walking alone, I try to think of chariots tearing down the hill, though the only thing I'm likely to meet is a cingale, a wild boar roaming around. One stream still has a trickle of water. Maybe a Roman messenger verging on heat stroke paused here as I do and cooled his feet when running south with news of how Hadrian's Wall was coming along. There have been more recent visitors. On the grassy bank, I see a condom and a wad of tissue. When I walk into town, I see a shriveled, pasty man who clearly is dying. He has been propped in the doorway with sun fully on him, his last chance for revival. He spreads out his fingers on his chest, warming everything he can. He has enormous hands. Yesterday I received a shock so hard my thumb went numb for half an hour. I was trying to pull the cord that turns on the overhead light in my study from the inside of the radiator, where it somehow had fallen. The clicker I had hold of split, leaving me with my thumb on the hot wires, my other hand on the metal radiator. I screamed and jumped back, that mindless, animal feeling of shock. I wonder if the man in the doorway feels that way in the sun, his life force siphoning off, the great solar energy coming at him, filling him up. His wife sits beside him and appears to be waiting. She's not mending or pinching back her flowers. She's his guard for his trip to the underworld. Perhaps she'll dry his dead body, then anoint his bones with olive oil and wine. Or maybe the heat is getting to me, too, and he's just recovering from an appendectomy. We must go to Arezzo, about half an hour away, to pay our insurance for next year. They seem to expect us to turn up rather than send a check. We park in the brawling train station lot. The station's full-sun digital thermometer clock says it is 103 degrees Fahrenheit. After our pleasant interview with Signor Donati, an ice cream, a stop for Ed to buy a shirt, and one for me to buy hand towels, we come back to the car and find the big 111 degrees flashing over the car. The door handles appear to be on fire. The heat inside slams into us. We air out the car and finally get in. My eyelids and earrings are hot. Ed touches the steering wheel with his thumbs and index fingers. My hair seems to be steaming. Stores are closing. It's the hottest part of the hottest day of the year. At home, I lower myself into a cool bath, wet washcloth over my face, and just lie there until my body takes on the temperature of the water. Siesta becomes a ritual. We pull in the shutters, leaving the windows open. All over the house, ladders of light fall across the floor. If I am mad enough to take a walk after 1:30, no one is out, not even a dog. The word torpor comes to mind. All shops close during the sacred 3 hours. If you need something for bee sting or allergy, too bad. Siesta is prime time for TV in Italy. It's prime time for sex, too. Maybe this accounts for the Mediterranean temperament versus the northern. Children conceived in the light and children conceived in the dark. Ovid has a poem about siesta written before the first millennium turned. He's lying relaxed in the sultry summer, one shutter closed, the other ajar. The half-light shy girls need, he wrote, to hide their hesitation. He goes on to grab the dress, which didn't hide much. Well, everything is always new under the sun. Then, as now, a quick wash in the bidet and back to work. What a marvelous concept. For 3 hours in the middle of the day, you are invited to your own interests and desires. In the good part of the day, too, not just the evening after an 8 or 9 hour day slogging away. Inside the high-roomed shuttered house, it's completely silent. Even the cicadas have quit. Peaceful, dreamy afternoon. Partly for the pleasure of my feet, sliding on soothing koto floors. I walk from room to room. The classic look, I've seen it 11 times before, and now I see it again in the new living room. Dark beams, white brick ceiling, white walls, waxy brick floors. To my eye, the rugged textures and the strong color contrast of the typical Tuscan house create the most welcoming rooms of any architectural style I know. Fresh and serene in summer, they look secure and cozy in winter. They impart a connected sense. I could live here. The architecture seems natural, as if those houses grew out of the land and were easily shaped by a human hand. In Italian, a coat of paint or wax is a mano, a hand of that substance. Before the plastering started, I noticed Fabio's initials scratched in a patch of wet cement. The Poles, I remembered, wrote Polonia at the base of the stone wall. I wonder if archaeologists find many reminders of the anonymous hands behind enduring work. On the wall of the prehistoric Pêche-Mûre cave in France, I was stunned to see handprints like ones children make in kindergarten above the spotted horses. The actual signature of the pre-literate artist outlined in blood, soot, ashes. When the great tombs of Egypt were open, the footprints of the last person out before the entrances were sealed remained in the sand, the last work finished, a day's work over. A butterfly trapped inside bats and bats the shutter, but does not find the way out. As I fall asleep, the fan drones, a shimmering head looking left and right. I love the heat. I love the excessive insistence. Something in me says yes. Maybe it's only that I grew up in the South, but it feels like a basic yes, devolving back to those old fossil heads of the first people who came into being under a big sun. The landscape appears cool, although it's cooking. The terraces aren't bleached this year as they sometimes are. Our view to the Apennines is green and forested. In someone's swimming pool at the bottom of the valley, I see a little stick figure jump in. Since we're up high, nights cool off to a lovely softness. In late afternoon, heaps and piles of clouds cross over, their shadows roving across the green hills. Tonight, the Perseids shower. It's San Lorenzo's night of the shooting stars, cause for a celebratory dinner. We've seen them before, and we know the gasps, our quick pointing a second too late, the bright cascade of a meteor, so momentary, so long expired. The garlic soup, chosen over Boethius's philosophy, is chilling in the fridge. Lemon and basil chicken, an accidental discovery, and a terracotta dish of gratin dauphinois, an old Julia Child potato favorite I've made for years, are ready to cook. I have enough ripe pears to peel and slice and improvise a mascarpone custard for them to bake into. I scrub the bird droppings off the yellow table, spread the cloth I made over the winter from leftover fabric I once used for the wicker on my Palo Alto patio 15 years ago. I spent days on the double welting around the cushion for the chaise longue. I could walk out of that dining room door right now, fluff those cushions, tell the dog, down, walk into the yard filled with kumquat and loquat, mock orange and olive. Or could I? Everything stays. What chance then? What chance, when I bought that yellow-flowered bolt at Calico Corners, to think it would end up on a table in Italy with me in a new life? Like fanning through a deck of cards, my mind flashes on the thousand chances, trivial to profound, that converge to recreate this place. Any arbitrary turning along the way, and I would be elsewhere. I would be different. Where did the expression, a place in the sun, first come from? My rational thought processes cling always to the idea of free will, random event. My blood, however, streams easily along a current of fate. I'm here, because I climbed out the window at night when I was 4. All the summer fruits of the great Mediterranean sun have ripened. Beginning with cherries when I arrive, the summer progresses to yellow peaches.